Hello, this is Will Evans, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the August 27th, 2026 issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Leading off, the headline is Governor Kathy Hochul, 5 years in, makes her case for four more. This is written by Grace Ashford. 10 weeks before Election Day, Governor Kathy Hochul is undeniably well-positioned. The governor, a Democrat, has a $20 million war chest and the wind at her back in a state where her party's registered voters outnumber Republicans 2-1. Even so, Ms. Hochul, who's 67, has something to prove. Despite New York's rebound from the coronavirus pandemic under her leadership, she has struggled to push her approval ratings above 50% during her 5 years in office, as New Yorkers continue to grapple with soaring energy bills, rent, and other costs. A self-described Biden Democrat in a post-Biden landscape, Ms. Hochul has been buffeted with criticism from the left, which is pushing her to do more to tax the wealthy, and from the right, which views her centrist politics as inauthentic and ineffective. The most recent Siena poll showed her just 10 points ahead of her Republican challenger, Bruce Blakeman, the Nassau County executive, in the November election. In a wide-ranging interview with the New York Times on the eve of her anniversary, the governor reflected on her tenure, which began in the depths of the pandemic, and made the case that she deserved some credit for the state's recovery. People didn't know if their state would deliver for them, and I set forth to prove to them that this could actually be a force for good, she said. She added, I believe we have restored confidence in people, in the state of New York. When Ms. Hochul was sworn in, the circumstances were sobering. Her predecessor, Andrew M. Cuomo, had resigned in disgrace. Tens of thousands of New Yorkers had died of COVID-19. With violent crime on the rise and remote work becoming the norm, Midtown Manhattan felt like a ghost town. People were writing the obituary for this city and this state, she said. Today, the picture is very different. Crime is down, employment rates and tourism have largely rallied, and, as the Knicks' championship victory this summer made clear, people are celebrating again. As proof of the state's rebound, Ms. Hochul described a recent Sunday when she visited Coney Island. After a walk down the boardwalk with her husband, the governor stopped into Ruby's Bar and Grill for a beer. At the bar, she said, she met a crew of older women in blue dance uniforms who were incensed that their governor did not recognize them. You don't know the Pacemakers? We just performed at the Cyclones baseball game next door, she recalled with a laugh. So I said, all right, let's turn on the jukebox. Show me what you got, Ms. Hochul recalled. Before long, she said, everyone in the bar was dancing. That, Ms. Hochul said proudly, is New York. Despite more than a decade in the public eye, including 7 years as lieutenant governor, Ms. Hochul has kept a more modest profile than her domineering predecessor, Mr. Cuomo. Her style is ruthlessly practical and occasionally hokey, and while it has yielded some real results, including her success in resisting some of President Trump's efforts to push his agenda in New York, she has not been floated as a potential presidential candidate, unlike the governors of some other large blue states. She often talks about being the first mom governor, a title that reflects not only her public persona, but also some of her proudest accomplishments. Expanding the child tax credit, offering paid prenatal leave, providing free breakfasts and lunches for students, banning cell phones in schools, investing $12 billion to expand access to childcare across the state. Jasmine Gripper, the head of the Working Families Party, said the governor deserved credit not only for the pandemic recovery, but also for her commitments on childcare and education, and her efforts to protect New Yorkers amid the president's mass deportation campaign and federal funding cuts. The thing that Kathy Hochul has gotten right is really governing for families, she said. Even on issues where the left-leaning party has butted heads with the governor, Ms. Gripper said, it had found her to be a good faith negotiator. The give and take is there. But Representative Mike Lawler, a Hudson Valley Republican, said that she had not used her executive power to impose moderation on the state's left-leaning lawmakers, resulting in a legacy of half-measures that had eroded voters' trust. "We continue to lead the nation in all the wrong categories. Highest tax burden, worst business climate," Mr. Lawler said, adding, "She responds to the polls. She doesn't lead." The Siena poll showed her with a seemingly narrower lead than in previous polls, though the surveys used different samples. But a narrow majority of respondents said they trusted her on key issues like affordability, public safety, immigration, and housing. "I'm real proud of what we've done in public safety," Ms. Hochul said in the interview. "And I'm going to say this, we're not done at all." Along with the pandemic, Ms. Hochul's early years in office were dominated by criminal justice cases on which she found herself at odds with many of her fellow Democrats in the state legislature. Ms. Hochul spent years and considerable political capital pushing to significantly tighten the bail reform measures that Democrats enacted in 2019 after the death of Khalif Browder, a young man who took his own life after spending 3 years in jail awaiting trial for stealing a backpack. The governor argued that the law was too lenient and inserted provisions to crack down on repeat offenders and give judges and prosecutors more leeway. Along the way, she developed her style of dealing with the legislature, even-keeled, iron-fisted, and apparently unbothered by complaints about increasingly late state budgets. That style has become increasingly evident as she has found herself negotiating with big personalities, from Mr. Trump to Mayor Zohran Mamdani of New York City. When Mr. Mamdani, a 34-year-old Democratic socialist, was elected last fall, many expected far less from his relationship with the governor. The two leaders represent different generations and different wings of the Democratic Party and have significant policy and ideological disagreements. But they quickly began working together to chart a course for an expensive but transformative investment in child care. Mr. Mamdani endorsed Ms. Hochul shortly thereafter. His support helped to doom the campaign of her progressive primary challenger, Lieutenant Governor Antonio Delgado. And the mayor and governor reached another major agreement this spring. Facing deep cuts in federal aid and a city budget deficit, Ms. Hochul pushed for a new tax on high-end second homes in New York City in the state budget, allowing Mr. Mamdani to claim a limited victory in his campaign promise to tax the rich. While the governor was less than thrilled with Mr. Mamdani's rollout of that tax, their partnership has so far proved durable, and some in the party are even looking to it as an example of a possible path forward at a time when the Democratic establishment has been shaken by leftist victories around the country. Representative Pat Ryan, a moderate Democrat from the Hudson Valley, praised the governor's collaborative approach. "I think her relationship with Mayor Mamdani is a national model of how to work across a broad Democratic coalition and not agree on every single thing, but focus on where you agree," he said, adding, "That is very hard to do in today's politics." Indeed, Ms. Hochul has often tangled with her party, particularly the left wing, over issues like taxes and climate policy. Environmental groups and some fellow Democrats were alarmed last year when she moved to weaken the state's landmark climate law. She has said that the state must adapt to changing economic conditions. Despite pressure from groups like the Democratic Socialists of America to do more to tax wealthy New Yorkers this year, the governor said in the interview that she had no intention of raising taxes or implementing new ones, though she indicated that could change if there were additional unforeseen cuts in federal aid to New York. But she has recently shown an increased appetite for taking on issues championed by the left in ways that align with her own priorities. Last month, she signed an executive order instituting a one-year moratorium on the construction of so-called hyperscale data centers while the environmental, economic, and social effects are studied. "I embrace tech companies," Ms. Hochul said, but she added she expects them to do their part for the state by delivering taxes and jobs. "If you want to come out, come and show a community you want them to benefit," Ms. Hochul said. "Help subsidize the utility bills." Our next article carries the headline, "Chicago program that set aside billions for development left poor areas behind, study says." This is written by Nell Saltzman. A program that has successfully helped revive Chicago's once downtrodden downtown has been less effective in the city's poorer neighborhoods, including many on the south and west sides, a sweeping study published Wednesday found. Authorities by state lawmakers more than 40 years ago, the Tax Increment Financing Program, or TIF, aims to revitalize struggling neighborhoods by stimulating economic development. When the city designates a TIF district, it freezes the assessed property values in that area for at least 23 years. Any future extra tax revenue generated from rising property values is earmarked in a TIF fund and reinvested in the development of that same or surrounding area. The money can be used for the construction of parks, schools, and infrastructure, as well as incentives for private, commercial, and residential development. As the theory goes, projects funded by the TIF cause the value of the surrounding properties to rise, fueling more growth. But the new study argues that nearly all of the increases in property values would have occurred organically without the program. "Chicago has utilized this program far more than any other major American city," said Juan Gonzalez, a senior research fellow with the Great Cities Institute, an economic research hub at the University of Illinois, Chicago, that published the study. "Over the decades, the program morphed into a runaway development tool with little accountability to the public." The researchers spent more than a year analyzing Chicago's use of the TIF since the program was first implemented in the city's downtown in 1984, reviewing contracts and creating a data set that included property assessments and tax rates. The analysis relied on publicly available data, which spanned different time periods and contained errors and gaps. The program has thrived as intended downtown, now brimming with offices and restaurants. But the researchers found that it has been less successful in poorer areas, which have largely failed to see transformative change, partly because of decades of underinvestment. Among the funds the researchers were able to track was $9.4 billion allocated for a mix of 1,427 public and private development projects across the city. Of nearly $2.6 billion in TIF funds used on private projects, 64%, around $1.6 billion, was allocated to five neighborhoods in and around downtown. The researchers estimated that five communities on the south and west sides received $55 million in TIF funds for private projects, barely half as much as the near north side, the lowest recipient among the downtown neighborhoods. Downtown communities didn't only benefit from private development. The researchers also found that almost half of TIF spending they tracked since 1986 for projects such as affordable housing, parks, and roads was also concentrated in and around downtown. Instead of reducing the city's historic economic inequities, it has exacerbated them, Mr. Gonzalez said. Jan Bruckner, a professor of economics at the University of California, Irvine, who developed a model on TIF's effects on public services in Illinois two decades ago, said the research was well done. Mr. Bruckner was also, who was not involved with the study, emphasized that TIF districts collect tax revenue generated by improvements, as intended, but also keep revenue from overall property value inflation, which is then not available to the city. Supporters of TIF have long argued that the program generates private investment, jobs, and increased property value that would not have otherwise occurred. But the researchers compared the change in value for properties that were closest to TIF projects to values for properties that were farther away. They found little difference, estimating that over 98% of the increase in property value within TIF districts would have happened without the program. William Fulton, an urban studies professor at the University of California, San Diego, and a former San Diego City planner who was not involved with the study, cautioned that the comparison was not an apples to apples and that the 98% figure was likely inflated. What it assumed is that the parcels in or near the TIF and the neighborhoods in or near the TIF are exactly the same as the parcels in the neighborhood a little further away, which may or may not be true, he said. Critics argue that TIF diverts tax revenue that could have otherwise gone to local agencies, such as public school systems, fire and police departments, and park districts, which have to divide up the amount of property tax frozen before a TIF area is designated. The researchers concluded that homeowners faced higher property tax rates over time to make up for the diverted revenue. Researchers assumed that if the city had access to that revenue and applied the funds for basic services, property tax rates would not have increased as much. They estimated that a Chicago homeowner with a $300,000 home paid $878 in 2023 to make up for the amount of property tax revenue diverted to TIF. Overall, researchers estimated the homeowner paid $6,616 from 2014, that is, to 2023. To calculate how much revenue was diverted to TIF and its possible effect on local agencies, the researchers analyzed tax bills from some of downtown's most valuable properties. Google's Midwest headquarters, for example, paid $7.6 million in property taxes in 2025, of which 98.2% was funneled into a local TIF account. The rest of the tax revenue was divided and distributed among local city services. The share of tax revenue that Chicago Public Schools received in 2025 was $73,126, equivalent to roughly one teacher's salary. The researchers did not recommend eliminating the program, but they suggested a handful of reforms, including implementing independent oversight and reducing the amount of property tax revenue diverted from basic city services. They also suggested that the city phase out downtown TIF districts that have accomplished their goals so local agencies could collect more tax revenue. There is no question that TIF is a powerful but flawed and inequitable tool for economic development, Griffin Kruger, a spokesman for Mayor Brandon Johnson, wrote in a statement. The Johnson administration says it is moving away from relying on the program to spur development. Mr. Kruger pointed to a $1.25 billion housing and economic development bond that he said would be a long-term source of flexible, equitable funding. When a TIF district expires, the tax revenue it holds goes back to local agencies. A portion of that revenue will help to fund the bond, which was approved in 2024. The bond program aims to invest up to $3 billion across Chicago by 2028. The city says the program will prioritize affordable housing and commercial projects on the south and west sides. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Our next article, it carries the headline, "The Warning Lights Are Blinking Again." This is from the opinion page, and it's written by Jen Easterly. We have a dangerous habit of taking warning signs seriously only after a catastrophe has taught us what they meant. I have spent much of my career on the other side of such warnings, in counterterrorism and cyber defense. That experience has taught me that too often the signs of impending danger are visible. What is missing is the ability to assemble the signs into a picture compelling enough to prompt action. the 9/11 Commission called this a failure of imagination. Over the past several weeks, some of the world's most advanced artificial intelligence systems took actions their creators did not intend. In one case, an Anthropic AI agent attempted to plant malicious code in open-source software, using fabricated identities to deceive a human into executing it. In a separate event, a swarm of OpenAI agents undergoing evaluation autonomously penetrated the production systems of Hugging Face, a platform used to share AI models, executing more than 17,000 autonomous actions before Hugging Face contained the intrusion. OpenAI did not realize for several days that its agents were responsible. None of these incidents led to consequential harm. That is precisely why they are easy to dismiss. But with AI capabilities advancing at extraordinary speed and behaving in ways we often can't anticipate, we cannot afford to wait for disaster to tell us which signals mattered. Our failure of imagination has to end here. 25 years ago, the systems were blinking red as George Tenet, the CIA director at the time, described the flood of information that arrived before September 11th. The summer of 2001 brought the so-called Phoenix Memo, which flagged an inordinate number of people of interest at Arizona flight schools, intelligence that two known Al-Qaeda operatives had entered the United States, and a steady stream of classified reports pointing to an imminent plot. The information was there, but only in hindsight was there an urgency to understand what it all meant. The pattern extends well beyond terrorism. Before the Challenger space shuttle explosion in 1986, engineers at a NASA contractor warned that cold weather could compromise the integrity of the shuttle's O-rings. Before the financial crisis of 2008, evidence of deteriorating mortgage standards and dangerous leverage accumulated in plain sight. Before the 2011 nuclear plant meltdown at Fukushima, Japan, multiple analysis predicted that a large tsunami could overwhelm its defenses. Not every warning warrants drastic action, of course. But again and again, institutions discount evidence because it seems costly or alarmist to act before danger is certain. When disaster arrives, what was once ambiguous suddenly looks unmistakable. Today, many warning signs are emerging from the world's leading AI labs, with companies racing to build systems of immense power with little meaningful regulation. The familiar response in these situations is to wait for an AI system to cause consequential harm. An autonomous cyber attack that significantly disrupts access to power or clean water, or a model that helps a terrorist build a biological weapon, and only then hold hearings, appoint a commission, impose new requirements, and ask why we did not act sooner. What we need urgently is an AI early warning mechanism that assembles weak signals, imagines what they could mean together, and forces decisions before the picture is complete. Every week, the federal government should convene an AI Risks Council, bringing together technical leaders from America's frontier AI labs, like Anthropic and OpenAI, with the government's top intelligence and security officials. They should examine incidents, near misses, and newly discovered capabilities across proprietary and open-weight models, including intelligence about capabilities emerging from China and other foreign developers. Armed with that information and expertise, the council could answer the question, what is the most dangerous, plausible story these signals could be telling us, and what should we do now if it was true? Each meeting should produce a classified assessment of the most plausible scenarios, the evidence for and against them, key gaps in what we know, and concrete steps to reduce the risks. Getting ahead of this risk would not require a wholesale reorganization of government. It wouldn't even require a new agency or new statute. at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which I led from 2021 to 2025, we built a version of this approach through the Joint Cyber Defense Collaborative, bringing technology companies, including AI labs, infrastructure operators, and government officials together to share sensitive threat information and plan collective defenses. The point was to turn public-private partnership, a phrase that has curdled into a bumper sticker, into a real operational collaboration. Information sharing that was timely, relevant, and above all, actionable. It was imperfect, and it was hard, but it demonstrated that fierce competitors would cooperate on security when government convenes them with purpose. What that earlier effort did not have, and what this moment demands, is cadence and consequence. As an AI Risks Council cannot be just another discussion group. Its weekly assessment should go to a single senior White House official accountable for determining what happens next, with the authority to order additional government testing, convene an emergency response, and elevate the gravest risks to the president. None of this requires believing the catastrophe is inevitable or even likely. It requires accepting that if the worst outcomes are preventable, the moment to prevent them will necessarily come before the evidence is complete, before the cost of delay become obvious. We should not confuse uncertainty with safety. We should not wait for the warnings to become wreckage. And we should not need another commission report to tell us, after the fact, that the systems were blinking red. Our next article was written by Karun Demirjian. Trump threatens to rename Lake Ontario as trade war with Canada heats up. President Trump on Tuesday threatened to rename Lake Ontario as Lake America, the latest in a stream of provocations he has hurled at Canada as its leaders as a trade war heats up. The United States is giving serious consideration to changing the name of Lake Ontario to Lake America, Mr. Trump wrote in a social media post, rationalizing the change because we don't expect to be doing much business with Ontario any longer. The president's post was his latest verbal attack on Canada as the two countries exchange increasingly punitive threats over taxes on trade. The trade dispute escalated over the weekend as talks between the two neighboring countries broke down. Last week, Mr. Trump announced that U.S. negotiators had reached a deal with Canada to head off his plans to impose 50% tariffs on a range of Canadian goods. But Canada, the United States' second largest trading partner and longtime ally, said the offer on the table was a bad deal, and tariffs on some $20 billion in goods came into effect Saturday. On Tuesday, Prime Minister Mark Carney of Canada announced retaliatory tariffs of up to 50% on hundreds of American products, dollar for dollar, after Mr. Trump threatened more duties on steel, cars, trucks, and related parts beginning next year. Mr. Trump also has taken aim at the Premier of Ontario, Doug Ford, who had been one of the driving forces behind Ottawa's opposition to the deal the United States had proposed. Mr. Ford told Mr. Carney that the terms were unfavorable to Canadian car and steel manufacturers, and that his province wouldn't comply with a requirement to restore sales of U.S.-made alcohol, according to people familiar with the negotiations. In an earlier social media post on Monday, Mr. Trump quipped that Mr. Ford was overall unimpressive and warned that someone should get those clowns to fall in line or the consequences for Canada will be far worse. To drive his point home, Mr. Trump also posted a marked-up map of the lake, the smallest of the five Great Lakes, and which separates the Canadian province of the same name and New York State. A big red X crossed out the words Lake Ontario, and in an oversized gold font, Lake America replaced them, flanked by an American flag. The name change is reminiscent of Mr. Trump's move to rename the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America, a change he demanded by executive order on the first day of his second term. Historical references to Lake Ontario predate the founding of either the United States or Canada. The name is thought to be derived from an indigenous term meaning either beautiful water or Great Lake. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Moving to our next article now. She Was One of Us, to Tennesseans, Dolly Parton's death hits home. This is written by Emily Cochran. Before she became a country music icon, Dolly Parton belonged to Tennessee. Her rise to fame started, of course, with her music, an album cover featuring the view from an eastern Tennessee porch, songs about the humble lessons of her impoverished childhood, the performances at the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville. But even as her star power took her all over the world, she made a point to keep coming home in different ways. She donated millions of dollars to disaster relief after devastating fires in East Tennessee and crucial vaccine research at Vanderbilt University. She built the sprawling amusement park Dollywood in Pigeon Forge near her hometown, Sevierville. And before her autobiographical musical headed to New York, it had its world premiere in Nashville. "She stayed true to us," said Christy Ferris, 51, who drove to her job on Tuesday at a gift shop in downtown Nashville, playing "Here You Come Again" with her windows rolled down. "I don't know if anybody could replace her, or even come close." So, as the nation mourned her death on Tuesday, the grief was perhaps the most profound in Tennessee. The idolization of Ms. Parton, or just Dolly as she's known, often seemed to be the one thing everyone could agree upon. "She inspired Tennesseans to be better, because she was one of us," said Beverly Keel, a music industry veteran who is a dean at Middle Tennessee State University. She added, "I can't express the profound grief Tennessee will experience this week." Ms. Parton, who was 80, had been dealing with health challenges for months. She died in Nashville after a brief battle with cancer, a spokesman said on Tuesday, the announcement reverberating throughout the state. In Nashville, it is hard not to catch a glimpse of Ms. Parton's influence. Her signature visage, piled blonde wig, beauty mark, wide grin, is captured on murals, t-shirts, and pins. Her songs are on repeat in stores and at music venues. "She just always seemed immortal," said Scout Gillette, 31, a singer who was in town to perform at an East Nashville venue and found herself grappling with grief in the Country Music Hall of Fame's exhibit on Ms. Parton. "It's just amazing how many people she touched." At the Hall of Fame, a line formed as people filled out a condolences book for Ms. Parton's family. Flags were lowered to half staff, and politicians and artists alike offered their condolences. Flowers were laid at her star on a walkway across from the Hall of Fame. The honky-tonks along Lower Broadway performed her songs in tribute, while cars blasted 9 to 5, and other songs. "She stayed so respectable and didn't really waver from who she truly was from the age of 10 until the age of 80, said Aaron Russell, who was visiting Nashville from Connecticut and had inherited a love of Miss Parton from her Alabama-born father. A friend had reached out, she said, wondering if being in Nashville on Tuesday was the equivalent of being in London when Princess Diana died. Farther from downtown, flowers piled up near a mural in East Nashville. People sniffed back tears as one young woman sketched oil pastel butterflies in a notebook. It was a break, she said, from mourning a woman who had been a fixture since childhood. And at the Grand Ole Opry on Tuesday night, the show opened with Rhonda Vincent, an Opry member, performing "Coat of Many Colors." She softly told the crowd, "This is for Dolly." Throughout the night, performers sprinkled in their own memories of Ms. Parton. "If you were a Tennessean, you were probably touched by her in some way," said Charlie Matos, a local radio announcer. In East Tennessee, where Miss Pardon had spent her childhood and many years building Dollywood, there was an even more profound sense of loss. The city of Sevierville, where Miss Pardon was born, said in a statement that the world has lost an icon, but Sevierville has lost a daughter who never stopped loving her home. Natalie Tyson, 41, said she was particularly moved by Miss Pardon's contributions after a wildfire in Sevier County killed over a dozen people in 2016. At the time, Miss Tyson had just moved to the area from Florida, and she lost about half of her belongings in the fire, she said. Dolly really came through and helped out a lot, and that really cemented her in my heart and a sense of community, said Miss Tyson, who has a tattoo of Miss Pardon on her thigh. On Tuesday, hundreds of people gathered at a statue of her on the lawn of the old Sevier County Courthouse to leave flowers, balloons, and other mementos. Hannah Sanderson, 35, brought her children, Evie, 10, and Owen, 8, to the statue and placed yellow roses in the growing memorial. If anybody deserves to have respects paid, it's Dolly, she said. Our next opinion article carries the title, I'm the Guy Who Sat in Front of You at the Beach. And this is written by Thomas Beller. My family, newly arrived at our vacation rental in the Hamptons, is going to the beach. We drive over to Amagansett to a beach that takes our temporary permit and unload. Two of us get dropped off near the sand, take everything and set off in search of a spot on the beach, while two of us head off to park the car. My teenage daughter and I are in the forward expedition. After that first moment at the entrance spent regarding the tableau of sand and sea, all the beachgoers and their umbrellas, we decide to go to the right. It's not too crowded, and it takes only a couple of minutes to get to where it's even less crowded. When we come to what seems like an acceptably vacant spot, I drop everything and begin to set up the umbrella. Then I hear a man's voice behind me. I don't believe it, he says. The tone is not warm. My daughter and I are setting up in a gap between other people who are perched on the ridge overlooking the ocean. Following the voice, I now see that there is a couple sitting in chairs higher up on the beach behind us. As a lifelong New Yorker, I'm used to the tiny, unspoken negotiations over space, on the subway, on a park bench, on the sidewalk, waiting for the light to change. But I wasn't expecting it on the beach. You have miles of beach, and you decide on the spot right here, the guy says, right in front of me. He is shirtless, wearing a white bucket hat, and has zinc on his nose. A woman around his age, which is approximately my age, is seated beside him, also in a beach chair. They are under an umbrella. I stare at him dumbly because I am still unclear if he is kidding and being friendly, or not kidding and not being friendly. It happens every time, he continues, in an irate tone that suggests he is not kidding. It's because you are so attractive, I say. People are drawn to you and want to be in your orbit. I smile, trying to situate the somewhat obnoxious remark I just made in the quadrant of amiability. You could go anywhere on this beach. Are you being serious? We could move, I say. In response to this, the woman sitting next to him, presumably his wife, starts shaking her head no, and gesturing with her hands in the manner of an umpire calling a base runner safe. The implication, don't move, don't worry about it, ignore him, it's fine. But I am flustered and don't trust my interpretation of her gestures. Better to cut our losses. You don't come to the beach to get in a shouting match. Spatial awareness, he continues, you have to have some, otherwise. The phrase spatial awareness makes me want to call back, you mean situational awareness? But I refrain. I read about the collapse of a hedge fund of that name, situational awareness, just the previous day. The fund was focused on investments in artificial intelligence. The drama was partly that it had collapsed, and partly that the billionaire investor Ken Griffin had made a middle-of-the-night deal to bail it out. Previously, Mr. Griffin was in my thoughts because he bought an apartment in 2019 in one of those buildings along Central Park South, the ones that look as if they were giving the whole city the finger. That is the most expensive apartment in New York. I thought about how that apartment, and so many others in those buildings, must be empty for most of the year, and how nice it would be to be able to set up a laptop at a desk and work there in solitude for a few days. I recently read a profile of Mr. Griffin in the New Yorker, and the other detail about him that stayed with me from that article is that, apparently, he rarely blinks. I stare at the guy on the beach, who has been yelling at me in a mode of incredulity. I blink, but not that often. "It's not a big deal to move," I say. The fact is, his irritability has lent him a slight aura of integrity, even if I think he is essentially being a jerk. In a different context, I think we could even be friends. I always feel that fights have the seeds of friendship within them. Not always, but sometimes. I've long felt that the corollary to my New York-bred appetite for confrontation is a kind of excessive gallantry. Giving up your seat on the subway, holding the door of a bus for a rushing fellow commuter, generally letting other people go first, often with a slight gesture of the hand and a nod, as though we all took turns being a maitre d' showing a regular customer to his or her favorite table. There is pleasure in being generous, and it also feels like a way of maintaining karmic equilibrium. I pick up the bag and chairs and umbrella and obligingly take a few steps to the left. In our new spot, 3 feet away from the old spot, we are slightly closer to a big group of 20-somethings. A modern tent thing is flapping above them. Their voices are slightly louder than they would have been in our old spot, but this, I tell myself, is part of the music of the beach. One must live among other people. "Is that better?" I yell back at the previously obstructed man. He stares forward, not responding. Satisfied that we have moved out of his view enough so that I don't have to talk to him or think about him, I finish with the umbrella, set up the chairs, and plop down on our newly claimed patch of beach. My daughter and I agree to suppress the news of this encounter when the wife and brother pair show up, on the grounds that was once amusing about it is likely to get lost in the telling, while what was stressful and annoying about it will probably remain. So, I forget about them, and later, when I come back from the water, I see they have left. Whether they left because of our presence or because they'd had enough of the sun and surf, I will never know. There is a 50-50 chance that our exchange felt so rancorous to them that it ruined their moment on the beach, so they left in a mood. And yet, admitting that I will never know also invites the opposite scenario. Perhaps he left feeling a grudging respect, even admiration, for me. There was something so familiar about the guy. He seemed like someone I could, or would, know, and even come to like. I will not be entirely surprised if one day, tomorrow or next week, he appears in some random place when we're all back in the crush of the city and says, "Hey, you're the jerk on the beach." And then we will look at each other, unblinking, and I will wonder whether he is joking. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. We'll turn to our next article now. She wrote about other people's sex lives, then wrote a movie based on her own. This article is written by Alessandra Shade. On a sweltering Saturday in August, the lobby bar of the Marlton Hotel in Greenwich Village was cool and dim. A few patrons spoke in hushed tones over espressos. "It's very quiet," Carly Scortino said, surveying the scene. "Almost too quiet for what I'm about to say." Scortino, 40, has made a career of saying what others will not. For nearly 2 decades, under the brand umbrella Slut Ever, she has turned private experiences into copy in a blog, a web series, a television show, and a memoir. She spent a year as a dominatrix assistant. She interviewed cam curls and escorts, and she wrote about nearly every relationship she had along the way. If I thought that something seemed like a bad idea, but it might end up being a good story, I would do it, Scortino said. Now, she has a movie out in theaters, I Want Your Sex, a sex comedy directed by Greg Araki. It started 13 years ago as a script Scortino wrote about a relationship she had with her much older editor. After a gender swap rewrite, it became the story of an artist, played by Olivia Wilde, who takes her much younger assistant, played by Cooper Hoffman, as a sexual muse. The role appealed to Wilde in large part because of Scortino's sense of humor. I find her work hilarious, refreshing, enlightening, and deeply necessary, Wilde said, adding that she shares with the writer a distaste for slut shaming. Scortino grew up in Highland, New York, about 80 miles north of Manhattan. She started her writing career 2 decades ago when she was living among a crew of young artists in a London squat with no heat or hot water. She chronicled her roommate's sexual exploits and her own on a blog called Slut Ever. I was writing as if the internet was written in pencil, she said. This was before Lena Dunham's Girls, before Amy Schumer's Mostly Sex Stuff special, before Nicki Minaj's Anaconda. At the time, writing about sex from a woman's point of view was considered quite trashy, Scortino said. She moved to Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and expanded her blog into a web series for Vice. It later became a Viceland TV show. Sally Singer, who was then Vogue's digital creator director, recruited Scortino to write a sex column in 2012. In-house, it was called the Emotional Health Column, Scortino said, adding that writing about sex wasn't very chic. It ended up running online for 7 years. She wrote about things that some people would consider trashy, but there's nothing trashy about the way she thinks and talks about them, Singer said. She's clever, and it was very well received. In 2013, Scortino wrote a screenplay based on the relationship with a man whom she would describe in her book as the first person to make me feel like my sex life wasn't something to be ashamed of, but rather part of what made me interesting. The script landed her an agent at ICM, who connected her with the veteran indie director Araki. The pair spent years trying to finance the project, but their efforts stalled. In 2023, Araki suggested revisiting the script and swapping the genders of the leads. The eager 25-year-old millennial woman would become an awkward Gen Z man. The Gen X editor would become a sexually adventuresome millennial artist. The changes gave Scortino a chance to play with generational mores. Millennials were the first generation raised on internet porn, where there was something aspirational in being sexually transgressive, in eschewing traditional ideas of what a woman should be like or what sex should be like, she said. When we rewrote the movie, the big difference is that the millennial woman who grew up on a very specific attitude towards sex is now dating a Gen Z man who is more reticent. Even so, the core of the story held. It's still a story about a young person finding confidence and possibility through sexual experiences, Scortino said. The film arrives in a cultural climate different from the one that inspired it. For Gen Z, dating has become something to opt out of. Scortino finds the sex recession sad. In every other aspect of life, we're told to lean in, play hard, make mistakes, she said. But with sex, it's the opposite. It's be safe or you'll end up traumatized. In March, Scortino described her own hiatus from sex and dating in a post for Hotline, her Substack. To recap, I'm 40, single, no kids, haven't had sex in 7 months. At any other point in history, this would make me a deeply tragic figure. But in 2026, I'm pretty sure it makes me trendy. Though the period of voluntary celibacy has ended, she is still searching for what sex means to her and other women these days. In I Want Your Sex, Erica tells her 25-year-old lover that sex is everything, that it forges us as human beings. Later, she takes half of it back. Sex is everything, she says. It's also nothing. And now we'll move on to our next article. He can't help rooting for the Mets and a better world. And this article is written by Jim Windhoff. Late in August, the New York Mets were coming to the end of yet another losing season. Even with the highest payroll in Major League Baseball, they were stuck in last place. That was more or less all right with A.M. Gitlitz, the author of the recently published Metropolitans, The New York Baseball Class Struggle, and The People's Team, an idiosyncratic history of the team and its relationship to leftist and populist movements. He understands all too well that the Mets are the Mets, a ball club known as much for its tragicomic ineptitude as its occasional moments of glory. If the Mets were more like, say, the New York Yankees, a team that has rattled off victories with business-like efficiency for more than a century, he might be less interested. Late on Tuesday afternoon, while riding the subway from his apartment in Manhattan's Chinatown to Citi Field in Queens, he suggested that some Mets fans had come to expect too much since 2020, when the hedge fund manager Steve Cohen bought the team for $2.4 billion. There were a couple of years when Mets fans kind of became like Yankees fans, he said, but it just seems wrong for the Mets to have that sense of entitlement. Gitlitz, who goes by Andy, is a Mets fan for reasons having little to do with the team's flashes of prowess. He likes the goofy mascots, Mr. and Mrs. Met. He appreciates that the Mets pitcher, Sean Manea, takes the subway to work. And when he considers Tom Seaver, he sees not just a historically great pitcher, but also someone who took a brave stand when he publicly decried the Vietnam War shortly before he led the Mets to victory in the 1969 World Series. Gitlitz was born in 1987, 25 years after the Mets' first season and 1 year after they won the World Series for the second and last time. His interest in baseball and political activism have run side by side since he was growing up in Yorktown Heights, New York, a hamlet about 45 miles north of Manhattan. His father, a fellow Mets fan, often took him to games. His mother died when he was a teenager. When Gitlitz wore his Mets gear to school, in his telling, he was taunted by the considerably more numerous Yankees fans who ruled over the halls with jock-like arrogance and took pleasure in bullying the nonconformists. I became fully convinced the Mets were the team of a downtrodden underworld of artists and radicals, with the Yankees representing the contemptible, dominant ideology, he writes in Metropolitans. That youthful notion would grow into the book's thesis. He spent his college years at SUNY New Paltz and the New School in New York City. After graduation, he started writing about the Occupy movement and related subjects for the New Inquiry, an online journal. He paid the rent by delivering food before switching to marijuana. It was a very good job when weed was illegal, he said. His first book, I Want to Believe, Postmodernism, UFOs, and Apocalypse Communism, came out in 2020. Since then, he has earned a living as a writer and as a host of This Wreckage, which he called a dirtbag left podcast. Despite his tolerance for losing, he wouldn't mind if his team came out on top a little more often. As the 7 train hurtled above Queens, he mused that the Mets' recent 4-game winning streak could be the start of a turnaround, taking them from the basement to the playoffs. They might be on one of those runs, he said. I mean, they're going to have to win another 25-30 games. Not impossible. There were long lines outside Citi Field. Although there was a promotion on, Reversible Bucket Hat Night, Gitlitz thought the turnout might have had more to do with the winning streak. They're playing really well right now, he said, as he walked past a hulking statue of Seaver. Inside the stadium, he picked up a veggie burger and a can of Dos Equis at the Vegan City food stand. After settling into his field-level seat along the right field line, he took a moment to describe what he sees when he watches baseball. "You have this defensive team whose singular goal is the production of outs," he said, gazing out at the grass. "Then somebody from the other team comes up holding a big stick. He tries to hit the ball in play, causing all this chaos that allows him to run around the bases and safely make it home." Contrary to popular belief, he continued, "baseball was invented not by farmers or urban laborers, but by Manhattan's middle-class office employees. The game," he said, "became an expression of their uneasy position in the social hierarchy, caught between the workers, whom they envied and resented, and the elite. The hitter, in this view, is acting on the office employees' pent-up desire to wreak havoc on the system. By smashing the ball, he is giving himself a chance to triumph over the mechanistic forces of modern life." They standardized the game in such a way that it was neatly balanced between defense and offense, Gitlicks said. As the rulebook proliferated, it was always seeking that balance, that tension. And this is the tension that drives capitalism. The game on Tuesday began when Fernando Tatis Jr., the slugging right fielder of the San Diego Padres, stepped into the batter's box. The Mets pitcher, Zach Thornton, threw a fastball. Tatis smacked it over the wall. Citi Field groaned. After just one pitch, the Padres were leading 1-0. In the bottom of the second inning, things were looking up. The Mets had the bases loaded, and Francisco Lindor, the team's star shortstop, was at bat. Gitlicks noted with pride that Lindor's wife, Katia Ruggiero Lindor, served Zohran Mamdani as a member of his inaugural committee when he was New York City's mayor-elect. Lindor slugged the second pitch over the wall in right field. There was a problem, though. Tatis leaping. He caught the ball before it could reach the stands, robbing Lindor and the Mets of a grand slam. Midway through the game, Gitlicks checked his phone and saw that several members of his group chat, Mets sickos, as well as a few other people he knew, were seated in the upper deck. He found his friends filling most of a row high above home plate. One wore a Mets jersey with Lennon on the back. Another was the indie film director Caroline Golem. "Did you see that catch?" Gitlicks asked, referring to Tatis's over-the-wall grab. "Horrifying," Golem said, "but also amazing." As the innings plodded by, Gitlicks paid a visit to another group of friends seated a few sections away. During the seventh inning stretch, they stood and swayed, arms across one another's shoulders, while singing "Take Me Out to the Ball Game." We returned to the field level for the bottom of the ninth. With the Mets losing 5-2, the sound system blasted a thunderous drumbeat. It failed to rouse the faithful. "Has this team already given up hope?" Gitlicks asked. "Is the game over for them? Is it over for the fans?" "Kind of seems like it." "Fly out, strike out, strike out." Another Mets loss. Gitlicks seemed deflated. For the moment, the game had killed his hope for a miracle run that would result in a playoff berth. But as we joined the crowd making its way toward the 7 train, he did some math in his head. If the Mets got hot in the season's final weeks, they might just pull it off. They'd have to lose once a week, Gitlicks said, at most. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the August 27th, 2026 issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Will Evans. Thank you for listening.